Valley 104.9 goes behind the scenes with former King County Council person Kathy Lambert every Tuesday at 6 p.m. and Sunday at 6 p.m. as part of Valley 104.9's Community Talk and Info Sundays.
And now, the conclusion of Kathy's discussion from last week. Let's take a listen.
So what if you get out on one of these rescues and you realize you need a tracker, you need a 4x4? How do you do that?
Yeah, so we have a command that starts at trailhead, and the command really does a lot of the logistical planning for the mission. I'm in the field and I find that I need more resources, more manpower, or even just more ropes or equipment, I'll radio down to command and request that resource. And then our base operations command team will then work and they'll call out whoever else we need if we need additional resource. I think a great example, we had a rescue for a cliffed out hiker on Mount Si, and we had a team that was hiking into the field and a Hasty team. And we our command team recognized immediately that we needed an ATV team to drive up the old logging road, which is now a trail, to the top of Mount Si. And we called out the regional special vehicle unit, and they came out with their ATVs, and they almost single-handedly brought probably about 400 pounds of gear with ropes and climbing equipment and a litter, even a bolt kit up to the base of Mount Si. And they were able to get there because they train, they're excellent at what they do. And they were able to get to the top of that in about 43 minutes, which is exactly what we needed. So it that was great because it thrived. I mean, I guess it joined almost exactly at the same time that our Hasty team was getting to the haystack on the Mount Si to get the equipment there at the same time.
400 pounds of equipment. Wow, that is amazing. Yeah. And you mentioned old logging roads, and this is something that is quite controversial. And I'm happy to hear you saying how important old logging roads are. And one of the things that people mostly don't understand is that the old logging roads, there are some people that want those logging roads to be taken out. And I fought very hard that they not be taken out for the very reason you just said. And in addition, when we nearly lost Carnation in a fire many years ago, we used those old logging rail trails as fire lines and trying to push the fire to one of the documented old logging roads, because we knew that that was cleared enough with as little vegetation as possible that we had better chance of putting the fire out there. So, you know, I know that there are lots of opinions because I got to hear them all, some louder than others, but for me, I think it's really important that the old logging roads and trails stay intact so that people can use them for emergencies. And usually emergencies mean that there's a human life or more. People don't always think that the human lives also are the rescue people, whether they be volunteers or other first responders. So that's great to hear about the logging road. So if one time I was at your headquarters in North Bend after you had gotten it all constructed, and that was a big project. How long did it take you to get that building all together?
Yeah, so I think we purchased that property in 2020. And we had an original plan to remodel the building, because it had been a structure that had been in a significant disrepair. There was about a 12-foot hole in the roof. And I think it was, we had to do a mold abatement and a number of things. So we initially had a plan to reconstruct that, within a year. And our original plan was to do work parties. So our team all pulled together, and it was all volunteer sweat labor there too, except for a few professional hires for a plumber and the roofing and I think drywall. But we were going to do it in a year, but we learned that the state of North Bend has a restriction on construction. I think it's on Sundays. You're not working on Sundays. And we want to be very respectful neighbors because we do have homes next to us that so we had to adjust from working Saturday and Sunday to Saturdays starting at 9 a.m. and could go to 5 p.m. So that pushed our timeline by a year. So we're able to finish construction remodeling in about 2 years, and we opened the building in June of 2023, grand opening, and it corresponded with our 75th anniversary of the founding of Seattle Mountain Rescue.
That is very exciting. So when you say remodeling, and then you talk about roofs and plumbing and all those things, it's a big remodel, and there was a lot of work being done there. When I saw it, one of the rooms was still in studs, but it's amazing the training space you now have too, which is great. And so I really was surprised when I was there that they asked me a series of questions, innocuous questions. And then they said, if you were lost, this is how you would behave. And I'm like, oh, yeah, how do you know that? And they said, from these questions. And I'm like, well, I don't understand how these questions that you asked me have anything to do with how I would respond. And they said, well, there's a whole psychology of being lost, which I had never heard, the psychology of being lost. My psychology of being lost is put an air tag in everything you own. So I was very impressed with that. Can you tell us a little bit about the psychology of being lost? Because I know you had, you as in the greater you, had something to do with it. And do you remember? Because as I've told people about this, they go, well, what were some of the questions? And I go, I don't remember the questions. This was, over a decade ago. But I do remember how shocked I was that those questions gave so much information.
We do a training on lost person behavior, and there's actually even I mean, there was a there you know there was a book for lost person behavior, and now we actually there's an app on your phone that we use to help us with lost person behavior, and there are certain criteria that you can look for, like you're saying, if a child that lost is most likely going to be within a 1 mile radius of where the point last seen. So we go through kind of that methodical list of do we know where the point last seen is? Do we know anything? The more information we have about the person who is lost and the characteristics, it really does help us frame an idea of where to begin key searches. And an example that I can give is there was a woman who was lost or missing near Mount Teneriffe, and people had seen her the interviews with people who saw her last had seen her going up to Teneriffe Falls, but that was kind of so we initially target a lot of that our resources to around the point last seen because mostly it's going to be around that area. We searched all the trails in the area, and we were actually now at this point where I think we were on day four or day five, and we did get a few additional clues that we later found out that the information we got on the point last seen was close to Teneriffe Falls, but what she had done was gone up to Teneriffe Falls, come back down, and then continued up the Teneriffe Trail, and we were able to locate her based on continuing to process through all of the different priority search areas and locations, and then we also ingest new data as it comes in. And so when somebody does go lost, because they do have a cell phone, Even though in this case she didn't have good cell coverage, there was a cell phone ping to a cell tower, and they were able to do a little bit more triangulation, and that helped us with a with data on point last seen to give us another search area. And so we'll go through the prioritization of search areas really until we exhaust all areas, or until we find the person. And ideally, we find the person within the first few hours. But that's the power of the volunteer teams, is that they don't want to stop. I don't want to stop. We want to keep going. And I think this is a maybe a different tangential topic, but I think talking about the resilience for volunteers. I know, like, if a subject is not found, I know that is that's really rough on the families and the people involved. But I don't know that listeners maybe necessarily know what the volunteers kind of go through. And this is like, I spend a large portion of my time in doing search and rescue. And when we can't or are unable to locate somebody, we try to put the positive spin on it and say, okay, well, we have searched every place that this person is not, and we know where they are not. So that gives us more information about where to search next. But if a person is not found, that there's a little bit of a it. It's an it's a I don't want to call it emotional trauma so much, but it's hard on the team. It's hard on the member to say, this is my purpose. This is what I'm out here to do. And one of the things that Sound Mountain Rescue has done recently, in the last 6 years, we're actually the only mountain rescue team in the nation to have a crisis care dog, a canine team, on our as actually members of our team. Ruffles and Bungie are our two crisis care dogs, and they are there for us. They're there to kind of help us process, either not finding somebody in the backcountry, or sometimes we find friends, family members, who are deceased on climbing trips. And those are difficult situations for our members. And this is one of the other things that I did not initially realize that we would get from our the Mountain Rescue Center in North Bend, is that it's a place for us to come back to, and it's essentially our safe place. It allows us to come back, decompress off of a mission. Ruffles is typically there, or Bungie, and so we're able to hang out, decompress, and be able to have that shared experience instead of just leaving the trailhead and going home and then having to deal or having to go straight back into, if a lot of our members have kids and the stresses of being a parent or a spouse and or other just day-to-day activities. So the resilience piece is something that is that we're embracing and trying to make sure we are taking care of our membership as well. And I mean, I'll put one other piece out there that we launched recently, because there was a Seattle Times article that came out last summer, written by Terry Wood, and he called me and was like, "Was I should I have called for rescue?" So he was kind of being critical of himself and beating himself up of maybe not beating himself up, but he was kind of really asking that critical question and maybe even questioning, "Should I have called for help?" We put through with Terry's work, we decided to put on our website a section that says essentially, "So you've been rescued, now what?" And that's that through our resilience team, that actually helped us understand and realize that a person who calls for help goes through their own maybe psychological trauma, not psychological trauma, but they go through their own processing of what happened. Did I make a mistake? What could I have done different? And we have on our website now tools to help people who have been rescued to better cope with all the different emotions that you may go th that a person might go through. There are a whole host of emotions that we know people that some of us who have been in climbing accidents before go through ourselves. So, yeah.
So, because I have talked with some people who have been rescued, some of the emotions that I've seen is guilt. Why didn't I come more prepared? Why did I get off trail here? Why wasn't I paying better attention? The weather was changing. Why wasn't I paying better attention to the time of the day? And had it been more light, I probably wouldn't have done this. So the guilt of that, and then the cost of, all of you coming out as volunteers and taking off from your jobs, which I want to mention in a minute. And then the embarrassment, that, oh my gosh, I just went out for a hike and then because I wasn't paying attention or I got injured or whatever, that I'm embarrassed. And then for both, there is some PTSD from the stress. Am I going to die on this mountain? And somebody else and the rescue team gets hurt. Am I, feeling guilty that they wouldn't have been hurt if they hadn't come out to get me? So there's so many emotions. And we have tried at the county, well, long ago, we got a dog for the domestic violence. And then we opened another situation where there was a dog available for the elderly in the elder abuse section of the prosecutor's office so that we had these dogs trained to be supportive in high trauma areas. And it wasn't just for the people coming in, but the staff. Also, as you said, there are cases that would make people so upset that somebody actually did this to somebody else that they too wanted some time with the dogs. And when I went down to their office one day, I was so surprised because the walls were all painted with dogs jumping and hopping and dogs everywhere on the walls. And I thought, okay, just setting a new tone of relaxing. And so I'm really glad that you're taking good care of not only the volunteers, but also the people like that, and acknowledging that you can't see some of the hard things in life that are literally life and death and not be emotionally involved. So if you are out and you're now 5 days into it, do you sleep out in the woods so that you don't have to get back to that place? Or how do you come and go?
It depends. So it depends probably on how far back, how deep into the backcountry our search may be. In some cases, yes, we had a search at Gem Lake, which is it's a ways back in there. So a lot of people hike to Snow Lake, but Gem Lake is the next lake past Snow Lake, and we had teams who would spend the night there and continue searching the next day. And so we generally have a sense of what our plan is going to be, but we always tend to plan that may change. And sometimes we have located a subject late in the evening, and because of weather conditions or whatever reason, generally, it's weather. If we can't get, and if the person's not terribly injured, and we locate them, we may end up spending the night with them, getting them fluids and food, and preparing for a helicopter evacuation the next morning, or if they're ambulatory, we'll be able to walk them out. But yeah, we have spent. I personally have spent several unplanned nights out. And sometimes a little bit cooler than expected.
Well, you have one vehicle that I went to the dedication of, and it was humongous piece of equipment. And it had, instead of tires, it had like these big track things that went round and round. And they had, again, because that's how you get things often, it was a military surplus. And I was surprised at how huge that machine was. And they said that they could put, a body and lots of gear in that. And when I say body, I mean either with us or not with us, so that you don't have to carry them out. And I don't know how often that huge machine can get where you are, but even if you brought it down, brought the rescue person down to a certain point where that huge machine could then show up. And do you coordinate with that big machine? I don't even know what it's called, but it was quite a bit of space, and I was really impressed to see that and see the dedication of that. Then, so talk to me a little bit about your employers. How do you deal with your employers to say, I'm going out right now to rescue somebody, and hopefully I'll be here tomorrow, but who knows? So, what kind of things do you encounter when you negotiate with your boss that you're going to be part of this group?
It kind of depends on each individual employer. So, what I love about our volunteer group is that we have volunteers from every walk of life. Construction, contractors, Boeing engineers, Microsoft engineers, Amazon. Every area that you can think of, electricians, every area you can think of, we have volunteers from. And we are fortunate that we do have, because we have firefighters, a lot of people have different shifts. And so we're generally always able to field, we're always able to field a team. Working with employers, it's probably up to each individual employer and your role within that organization. My boss knows that I do search and rescue, but I also know that I have a job to do. And the number one thing in all emergency response is you have to take care of yourself. Then you take care of your team, then the general public, and then the person who actually called for help. Since I have to take care of myself first, I have to make sure I stay employed so I can pay bills and those types of things.
And for all the equipment you have to buy.
And all the equipment I have to buy.
That's right.
One thing, so I used to be the president of the Mountain Rescue Association, the National Association of Mountain Rescue Teams. And one of the teams in, I guess, in the teams in the Los Angeles area, there are about nine teams there. Sierra Madre and Altadena. Actually, Altadena was heavily impacted by the fires. Learning from those teams, they are covered under like a National Guard type protection for their jobs, which I did not. I've 17 years. I was like, well, I'll ask my boss if I can go, and if I can, I can. If I can't, I've got to stay employed. So I was kind of surprised at that, and I thought, well, that's a pretty great thing to have, so that volunteers who you volunteer for search and rescue and you get called out. Certainly during the Altadena fires, I know talking with those team members, they were out. They were working 24/7 to help evacuate homes and get people to safety, and then helping people after that event. And if it had not been such a large event, an employer may not understand, or if your employer just doesn't understand, so I'm sorry, you've got a job to do. So that was an interesting idea. But what I find is that most employers understand and appreciate the volunteerism. One thing that I would share with listeners is, in my volunteer experience, I think I put in a fair amount of time into this.
Oh, I would say so.
But as much as I've gotten more out of my time in Seattle Mountain Rescue, and I've learned so much more out of my time in Seattle Mountain Rescue that it's given back more to me than I ever would have even dreamed or imagined. And it's not financially or but perhaps it is because learning about leading a team is actually beneficial to my job, whether I really know it or not. And so I think what I've encouraged people to do is whatever it is you are passionate about, if you can find a way to volunteer time back to that organization, to your community, it's a huge benefit. And it doesn't have to be hanging off of a cable from a helicopter. It can be any kind of organization that you like. And I there's a film, a documentary film that recently came out. It's called The Volunteers, Mountain Rescue Brings Us Home. The premise of this documentary is really about kind of what I similar to what I just mentioned. It's about being involved in your community and helping people in your community, whether they're tourists or just being part of your community. It's so important that and it's so rewarding. And it's too bad that people don't get an opportunity. People don't take the opportunity. There are plenty of opportunities there. And organizations around our county can certainly benefit and would use your time wisely.
Well, I think that's beautiful. And you know, there's nobody hanging from a helicopter that says, are you this political group? Are you this particular religion? Are you this particular X, Y, or Z? Nobody says that because it gets down to being human. We all want to do the best for each other. And I think that what you said is so beautiful because if everybody would just get to the idea that we are all part of the human body and do everything we possibly can to make the next person's life better. And I just finished reading a book called Rooting for Rivals. And it's talking about how when you lift up even your own competition, how the boats rise for everybody. And if we always think about that, that's important. And like you said, the skills of leadership, we can always learn more about leading and collaborating. And that adds to making it a better world for sure. So, thank you for sharing that. That was really good. Do you remember any of those questions that they asked on the survey about, you know, how would you react in a emergency?
I'm not sure that
Okay, that's fine.
I
So, but I'm
do.
glad to know about the app. That sounds
Yeah.
very exciting. And one of the things that they told me that I remembered is because we were working on some things on elder care, and they said that if a person with Alzheimer's leaves, that they usually go in the same direction, straight ahead, and they don't deviate. Oh, wonderful piece of information that is.
Right.
So I was so impressed with the whole situation. That was really amazing.
And I think in that regard, if they find an obstacle, that they're probably going to stop at that obstacle. So if there's a fence or a blackberry bush, they'll likely stop. I mean, they're not going to be thinking about, well, how do I go around this? Mainly because I don't know what's happening in the brain, but those are the things that we kind of look for or we think about when we're finding a lost person behavior.
If we wanted to find the film, Volunteer Mountain Rescues Brings Us Home, how would we access that?
My understanding, let's see, so there's the Volunteers doc. I believe that's a .com. It's yeah, the volunteers doc, doc.com.
Is it volunteer or volunteers?
Volunteers,
Okay.
volunteersdoc.com.
Okay.
And it shows where it's currently showing in film festivals. But I understand, I talked to the producer, director, producer, and they're working on putting that out on Amazon and PBS. I think it's a shorter version. It's a 56-minute version. Then I think the longer version's is more thorough for sure. But the story of it is really nice and is interesting.
Well, I think that will be good. I'm going to put that on my calendar for a month from now, to keep checking every month from now on until I can finally see that, because I think that sounds really good. And obviously, that's not one of my skills to climb from the top of a mountain. And so I'm thankful that people do have that skill. So I think we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about your relationship with Austria.
Local news, local info, Valley 104.9.
What inspires an author to write a book? How do novels and plays get written? Why are some books impossible to put down? Hi, I'm Richard Walensky, and I'll be speaking with authors getting to the heart of their creativity and their research on Bookwaves Sunday afternoon at 3:30 on Valley 104.9 FM.
Remember to join us at 1 p.m. on Sunday for Animal Radio. Animal Radio is America's most listened to pet show. The nearly two-hour celebration of our pets is hosted by veterinary talent Hal Abrams and Judy Francis. So tune in 1 p.m. Sunday, Animal Radio.
So when you've been talking about going out on these rescue missions and such, how many people have EMT certification? What kind of first aid training do you need to have?
Yeah, sure. So in general search and rescue, you just need to have basic first aid and CPR to join a search and rescue team. For Seattle Mountain Rescue, we require a wilderness first aid or wilderness first responder. But we have seven doctors on our team. We have four physicians assistants and eight EMTs. And everyone else is either wilderness first aid or wilderness first responder. Most of the time, my thought is that I feel really good about going out with my team because I know if something happens to me, I've got a whole medical staff there who's ready to take care of me. And I think that's really great for everyone in the backcountry too, is to know that not only is there a team within the county who is dedicated to coming out, but they're also highly skilled medically trained. Oh, and I forgot, we also have I can't remember the number of paramedics, but we also have paramedics on our team too. So, but we all, it, we, I feel always very confident of the medical training that we would have. I personally am wilderness first aid now. I started out volunteering at a fire department at age 17, and was an EMT starting there, and was a I volunteered with the Snoqualmie Fire Department and for several years, and was EMT there as well. And so just kind of helped carry that medical training forward.
That's excellent. And you had mentioned earlier that you have firemen, and so they are also trained, obviously, as paramedics. And the majority, it depends on the fire department, but mostly some of them have told me that they're fire calls are less than 10%, and the rest of their calls are paramedics. And as you may remember, because you were probably trained under Dr. Michael Kopis,
yes,
who was quite the trainer, and My brother did some of his advanced fellowship in orthopedics under Dr. Kopis. And so he is now the late Dr. Kopis, but his legacy will be forever. It was quite amazing. When Dr. Kopis spoke, that was the answer. No matter what, right. That was the answer. So exactly. We are very thankful that under his leadership, we were able to get highly trained, and I would guess one of the best paramedics systems in the entire country under his leadership. So how old do you need to be involved in one of the 9 units?
So the Explorer Search and Rescue, King County Explorer Search and Rescue team, I believe takes members as young as 14. In fact, one of our members, who I'll name Doug Cayley, just won the King County Sheriff's Office Volunteer of the Year Award. He'll be awarded later in February. He has been, his first mission, I believe, was in 1971. He joined King County Explorer Search and Rescue when he was 14 and has been in the unit for a long time. I won't try to try to guess the number of years, but I would easily say decades. And I think that goes to the passion that this type of volunteer really drive. Volunteerism just really drives. It's something that, and you do see it. You see it everywhere, not just search and rescue. You see that passionate docents at the Park Service, or just that great passion. But we're so lucky to have Doug Cayley as one of our members of Seattle Mountain Rescue, but of King County Search and Rescue as well.
And there's another man, and I don't know which of the units, but he was honored the other night for 50 years of service and still serving, Bob Gordon. And yeah. You could see his wife when he got the plaque honoring him, how proud she was as a wife for all the volunteer things that he has done. And he was very, very cute. And so it was fun to see that. So one of the things that we talked about at the event was your involvement with Austria. And I think that is so exciting. So will you tell us how you got involved with Austria and what's happening with that?
Yeah, it's an interesting, I think it's a slightly interesting story, but it seems so almost a random in a way, but also very at the core of our very founding with Seattle Mountain Rescue is, I was president of the Mountain Rescue Association, and I got an inquiry to our info email line, and about this historian, professor of constitutional law, was looking into some origins of Mountain Rescue, and this was kind of a little bit back during COVID. And one of our members had, during COVID, had plenty of time, taken a lot of our historical documents and scanned them into our Google Drive repository. And so we have mission reports and data that goes back to the 40s for our team. And so I directed Mark Weiner, who's the person who contacted me, to our member who was doing this scanning of documents. And as it would turn out, he was doing a project on the history of mountain rescue in Austria. And he found this connection to Seattle Mountain Rescue, where one of the members who, so there's this book called Mountain Rescue Techniques. It was written in German, And it was utilized in Austria for in the 1938, I believe. And the author, it's an interesting story, and it is detailed in the Volunteers documentary. But the author of this mountain rescue techniques was a card-carrying Nazi. And I don't know if that was like because you had to be at the time, or if or what, but that we they took that book. One of our founding members, Doc Otto Trott, took that book. He fled Nazi Germany or Socialist Germany at the time, and he was able to translate that book into English, and that became almost the a lot of the original techniques that we adopted in the early days of mountain rescue. I like this. I like that story because it takes something good out of a regime that was very, very bad and evil. And it's also I like the fact that Otto Trott was half Jewish and had fled that regime and was able to find something good out of that and make it good for the rest of us. That history story was basically all around this Volunteers documentary that Mark Weiner has put together. And that connection to Austria, we were at our 75th anniversary and the grand opening of our building. And Mark said something to me. He said, "Oh, wouldn't it be great to set up some sort of a exchange program with the Austrian mountain rescue team?" And I was like, "I'm in. When can we go?"
Next flight
And
out.
it's super exciting because it was later that September that five of us went to Austria on our own dime. We each paid to go, and we got to spend a week with the Austrian Mountain Rescue Team, and we toured a number of different of their toured a number of their different locations and buildings, and got to spend a couple nights in their training hut. And it was just a really amazing connection that we had the opportunity with, is that what we learned is that and Marcus Iser, who's one of the Austrians, he said it best and said, what would you say about similar or different? And Marcus said, "When I look at the Seattle Mountain Rescue, it's like looking at a mirror. It's like I see, I see myself there." And what we found that to be totally true is, other than our slight language barrier, we would be completely interchangeable if we were to go and join their team or they were to join our team. We just recently hosted the Austrian team in late September here in Seattle. And it was even more evident there is that this connection there is growing. And one of our members who organized and planned this entire event was, he came to me super excited and said, "Doug, what do you think if we bring the Austrians and we rappel off of the Space Needle?" And I was like, "Yeah, that sure. That I mean, that would be cool. I mean, I would actually be really exciting and love to do it." But in the back of my head, I'm like, I'm thinking, okay, legal fee, all the legal costs, the insurance, and I'm like, I don't know. And he came back to me and said, "Doug, you'd be surprised to know that." Unfortunately, they're not going to let us rappel off the Space Needle. And I was Partly, I was slightly relieved because I was thinking of all the liability and peace. But he said, but they did say we could climb the tower at the top of the Space Needle, and we worked that out, and we ended up. I'll show you there. In a picture that I'm showing you, Kathy, is we're standing at the very top of the Space Needle, and one of our members, or one of the Austrians, is at the very, very top, exactly where they changed the light bulb there. So, what's great about this relationship is, and I think the importance of this relationship for our rescue team is this shared learning between the teams. One of the things that was immediately interesting is that all of the same challenges that they have as a rescue team, we have the same ones, or all the same problems we have, they have. And so we're able to, talk about those types of things. Fundraising, they have challenges with fundraising, and just a number of different similarities. It's just amazing. But so the great thing is we're working to see how we can solidify this exchange program. And at the end of January, another small group of us flew to DC to watch the Volunteers documentary with the Austrian ambassador, and we started those conversations, and we're now talking about different opportunities between possibly the city of North Bend and one of the cities in the Tyrol, and trying to see, from a selfish perspective of how can we as mountain rescue teams work together. But I think on the broader aspect is how can we make this relationship and this mountain rescue relationship be beneficial to the broader community. And I'm super excited about, the possibilities there, and potentially even the economic benefits that we would be able to share to the city of North Bend, and to our good friends in Austria, to make this happen, to figure out how we make things happen. So we're at the very beginning of these conversations and discussions, but the great thing is the connections and the friendships that we've developed, the shared learning that we continue to do. And it's really based on how can we provide a better service to our community and be re better rescuers.
Well, I'm really excited about this. It says something about, two top-notch organizations, the Seattle Mountain Rescue and the Austrian Rescue. And when you take two brilliant teams and put them together, it's pretty exciting. And it means a lot of good things for our people. And I looked at some data on heart attacks. And we used to be the best in the entire United States recovering from a heart attack. And when I looked at different places across the country, like New York, do not have a heart attack in New York. And so, you don't think about the idea that, in fact, this EMT team in City X and this one here in City Y and this one over here in City Z has different outcomes for heart attacks. And since heart attacks are a pretty prevalent thing, knowing that we were one of the best, and I hope we still are, that we are so lucky that we have our paramedics trained the way that they are, that they've developed so many different things to make the rescue from paramedics in our area to be among the finest. And now we have, your group for the last 75 years, who's also continually working on making it better for all of the citizens to be safe when something happens, whether it's an injury or a loss and what would be in your purview, or if it's a heart attack, in your office or your home, that the people responding are so well prepared. If you send me that picture, I will put it up on my Twitter. So anybody interested, my Twitter is so hard to think of, It's Kathy Lambert. So if you want to see the picture, it'll be later on my Twitter. So thank you. That is an amazing picture. And I hope that the Space Needle did ask you to change the light bulb while you were up there. So save their team. So I did know something like that was happening, but I didn't realize who was doing it. And so that's very exciting to know that you did that. The other thing you talked about was collaboration and, you know, like a surgical team, you know, when you are the physician and you are doing surgery, you need to know that your nurses and your anesthesiologists and people know exactly what you're going to do next. And so the idea that your teams have worked together so well that, you know, it's kind of like a husband and wife. After a while, you just know what's going to come next. And having that with a rescue team is really important for everybody on the team. So that's really exciting. And I'm excited to hear in the future what the relationship from Austria holds. So I'd like to talk next about the 10 essentials. Mm-hmm. You're going to go hiking. What should you have with you?
Yeah, so as the 10 essentials are listed, you can certainly search them and locate them. We have a list on our website, and but you can find them. These 10 essentials are, I think we call them essentials because at the core, they will give you the opportunities to be able to survive an event that may happen. Accidents happen in the backcountry. They can happen anytime, and it's nice to be prepared and have these essential items. So I'll just read them off, and so everyone has them. We used to say map and compass. We still think that that's a good thing to have. Some people bring a GPS or a map, but it's some sort of navigation device. And always remember that any type of electronic has a battery life. And so maps and knowing how to use the map and compass is important. And then a headlamp. With if you have spare and spare batteries, if you have them, we do go on a number of rescues that people are out a little bit longer than expected and it gets dark, and if you're above the tree line, you might still be able to see if you have a full moon, but once you get into the under the canopy, it's very difficult to see. So navigation and a headlamp are important. Sun protection, even when it's cloudy. We get a lot of time in the Pacific Northwest. It's cloudy, but even still, those UV rays are getting through, and it's important to have sun protection. First aid kit, a knife or a multi-tool, some way to start a fire, whether it's a matches or a lighter, so you can create a fire to stay warm, some sort of shelter. This could be a tarp, or one thing that I like to do is, because it rains so much, I take a trash compactor trash bag and put all of my stuff that I want to keep dry in there in my backpack. But I can also use that as a shelter. Because if I need to, then I can use that and get out of the elements. So just use my knife and cut it to get out of the elements. So we're a shelter, extra food, extra water, and then extra clothes. And so, you know, these are all items that are essentially designed to or come together to help you be able to weather any type of emergency, whether that might be spending an extra a couple hours hiking out because of it's dark, or maybe spraining an ankle and having to sit and wait a little bit longer for, or having to sit and wait for search and rescue to come to help you out.
So I remember years ago when I decided I was going to start hiking, and they also said, you know, when I got to the trailhead, you know, write down your name, what time you're leaving the trailhead, and what direction you're headed, and what color your clothes are, and put it in the box. And I thought, oh, huh, be nice if I had a pen and some paper. And so, you know, just adding, so I started adding to my 10 essentials. But I remember going to the hiking store and saying, I'm going to take up hiking. What do I need? And it was the first time I'd ever heard of the 10 essentials. So I said, okay, I want all the 10 essentials. And so she said, what kind of compass do you like? And I said, I want the most commonly used compass. And she said, well, do you have, you know, a preference in any particular parts of the, of this? And I'm like, no, the most normally used one, because I don't know how to use a compass. And so I will give it to whoever is near me to use this compass. And she started laughing. She goes, well, you do know that you can go on the web and learn how to use a compass. So I came home and Googled how to use a compass. So there's a lot that you can learn on the web to make sure that you're safe. And a couple of things, you know, telling a friend where you're going, hiking with a friend. I know that there was a situation in North Bend where the person was hiking with a friend and that person's cell phone did not work. And this was prior to the new cell sites going up. And you'll be happy to know that designation was one of the ones that I made sure had cell site coverage. But anyway, this person had to run. The friend ran 6 miles to get to help. And I was telling a friend of mine, you know what? I'm not sure how soon I could run 6 miles. And so you might have a little extra time to just be waiting. So that's a lot. But it was great that the friend, you know, was able to do that. And then, of course, search and rescue went with the friend back to locate where the person was that needed to be done. One of the things I learned recently was that batteries explode. And I did not know that. And I knew it, but I hadn't seen it happen before. And so it completely demolished my flashlight. So I was like, at first I didn't really even know what it was. And I literally had to chisel the white stuff off of my flashlight, which ended up in the garbage can. But so now I went to all of my batteries, things, I took them out of the thing, I put them in a baggie and taped it so that I can look at the condition of my batteries to make sure that they are at least not having the white stuff connected to them before I put them back in. So that was a learning experience for me. And then if you know somebody's missing, would it be helpful to bring some clothing that that person has, so when the dog unit gets there, they have something that they can pick up the smell from?
Yeah, that's a great point. Any kind of article that the dogs can utilize is always useful.
So we have had so much fun talking to you, and you've been a wealth of information. So let's close with again reiterating, if somebody wants to donate, what would be the website to do so?
Sure. There are lots of different, there are 9 different teams in King County. The King County Search and Rescue Association website has a list of those teams that, and actually a donation portal there that you can donate directly to each of those teams. The teams also, SeattleMountainRescue.org, King County's Explorer Search and Rescue, and all the different teams do have websites and information, so you can donate directly to them. And they're all 501c3 tax deductible charitable organizations. That want to make sure that folks know that, so that when you're looking for that tax break, know that you gave to Search and Rescue to help bring everybody home from the backcountry.
Thank you. That's beautiful. I so appreciate your time, your talent, your expertise, and your personal contributions to making this a better county. And actually, we're working with Austria. I'm sure that you have given them some tips that they didn't know. And thank you for bringing home tips from them, too. So thank with you, that, Kathy. We end our Behind the Scenes with Kathy Lambert. And we are happy that you joined us. Good night.
Good night.
Kathy will be back next week with another new episode of Behind the Scenes, right here on Valley 104.9 Northwest Eclectic.